Welcome to our newest adventure for first responder wellness. No one fights alone. In-depth conversations about mental health and culture in the first responder space. We're joined by your co-hosts, Austin Pedersen and Brad Shepard.
Austin, my friend, we're back at it again on the No One Fights Alone podcast. It's good to be back, man.
I know we've missed you on the last two episodes. I didn't have to hear your voice while we were editing, so it was amazing.
My breathing? Actually. But you didn't have to. I know Zach is doing some editing for us now, and I'm sure that Zach is appreciative of not having to hear my big breathing sighs that I'm notorious for. But I heard the podcast went well. I know we're closing out some September. It's September 19th. We're closing out Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. And I think you had a couple good podcasts on suicide. I know the interviews with suicide with Leslie and Gina, just amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. A lot of people that have just, man, it just brings it to light how many people are struggling with this issue or have a family member or a loved one, whatever it may be. It just, there's a lot we can do these days now.
Well, I'm excited about our guest today, Brooke Greenig. Did I say that right? I mess that up all the time. Greenig. Brooke Greenig. Perfect. With River District Counseling up in Yankton, South Dakota. Welcome to the No One Fights Alone podcast, Brooke.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, I love having you on. So I've known Brooke for a couple of years. We met at a training event and we just hit it off right off. It was very easy to see we're kindred spirits, and she cusses like a first responder too. I love that for her. I already gave her permission, Austin, to say, "Hey, this is a full on cuss whenever you want podcast."
Yeah, if someone doesn't cuss, then they're not actually telling the truth. That's the reality.
We're suspicious of them a little bit, Brooke. Brooke, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where are you from? Where you hailed from? And well, I find it fascinating your educational background. I'd like to ask a couple questions about that, but tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah. So I actually grew up in southern Minnesota. It's kind of where I was for a long time. So oddly enough, I'll give you a story because I don't ever tell anybody this.
Love it.
But so I grew up in southern Minnesota, small little town. You know, didn't know much in life because I grew up in like a town of 13,000. And graduated high school and was going to go to college and put all my eggs in one basket. Actually, was going to be a lawyer. You can laugh about that. And so I applied to this little college out in Staten Island. And got accepted and went. And it turns out that, like, you know, that September, 9/11 happened. And so it was the first time I'd ever heard of terrorism. Don't shoot the messenger. I know that makes me sound like an idiot. But I was young, you know, and I had no idea what was going on. Scared the shit out of me. And so that was kind of a journey, kind of an experience. And I ended up coming home, which, you know, I didn't plan for, so kind of lost my way a little, lost my direction, but eventually ended up and got my undergrad in social work, and then turned around and got my master's in social work. And that's the program at USC, University of Southern California. They partner with the Department of Defense, the military social work. And so we took some extra courses there to get that degree. And then turned around and said I'd take the first job that I was offered, which just so happened to be in South Dakota at a hospital, inpatient hospital. So I've worked actually a lot of inpatient back in Minnesota. I worked maximum security forensic mental health hospital for like 12 years. So I've been in mental health since I was like 16, started working in group homes, et cetera. But yeah, and then ended up in private practice. Then had some more experiences, we'll call them, in private practice, and then turned around and decided that, you know, the best only way to go is to start my own practice and work alone. And so that's what I'm doing now. Am I your first South Dakotan on the show?
I think so, actually. Yeah. Is that right?
And you're our first, first from the University of Spoiled Children as well.
I knew that shit was coming. Come on. I earned that spot. And mm-hmm. I paid for it. I'm still paying for it, you know. So. Yeah.
So both my parents went to UCLA. Dad played football at UCLA. So we don't like USC in my household.
Well, I find that.
Even better.
I find it, some of your bio pretty interesting there. The military social work track, what sets that apart from any other social work mental health track?
Well, I mean, military culture is not something that they teach in the social work degree typically. So, and USC offered, there was a couple of different tracks, I believe. But no matter kind of where I looked, this was the only one that I could find. And so they did a lot of classes on, you know, military culture, working with military families, you know, individual therapy, trauma, you know, how to look when someone tells you something.
Has that helped
that you don't know one's used to hearing?
For sure. No, that's a unique culture. Have you found that has prepared you for the first responder culture, or is there enough differences there that what's the similarity or differences there with those?
I mean, I think there's a lot of similarities there. A lot of them go hand in hand because a lot of guys and gals get out of the military and they look for that same, you know, that same brotherhood, that same camaraderie, that same connection, and they find it typically in some sort of first responder, law enforcement population. And so I think a lot of it is the same. And so I think it did help, but I think the most important piece that I can take away, because I don't think learning about something one way makes us informed, you know what I mean? But it showed me that this is the most important part of working with these populations, is understanding their culture. And that's important for me because, you know, I'm not a first responder. I'm not a veteran. Sure, I got family and loved ones and et cetera, but I'm at a disadvantage out of the gate. And I know that and I respect that. And it definitely taught me that, like, you better understand it because you don't get second chances with this population. Like, you piss them off, you offend them, and I'm quick. I mean, okay, I probably piss off a lot of people, honestly. But, like, I have no problem being like, okay, help me understand, because, you know, I didn't realize that, you know, and I have no problem doing that. And apparently a lot of people in my profession work with this population and don't understand that component. And then it's like, well, that shoots my opportunity from helping them later on, because they're not going to go. They rarely go a second time when it goes poorly. I mean, that's just anybody. I mean, the horror stories that I hear about, well, my first time in therapy, you know?
Oh yeah.
I mean, to me, that's the most important takeaway, is that there is military culture. There is law enforcement culture. There is first responder culture. There is, fire. Just kidding. I love you. I love fire. I'm just kidding. So.
No, we love our fire. No, we love our fire jokes. Love the fire guys. That's a constant.
That's why I made him have a red sign.
That's a constant ribbing.
Notice I got the blue. And,
yep. Right here. He took blue first. Yep. Look, I'm the fire rep for No One Fights Alone. And they serve fire coffee at Chateau. I can't remember the name of it. What is it? Firehouse Coffee?
Fire Department Coffee.
Fire Department Coffee.
Fire Department Coffee. Yeah.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Well, Brooke, what was the little tour of duty you went in corrections? How was that experience?
Uh, 11 years of maximum security forensics taught me everything I need to know about mental health.
Well, tell us a story or two along that journey. Was there any good stories there?
Oh, I don't even know if I'd have one that'd be appropriate.
Probably none. I was just thinking that maybe none of them are appropriate for the conversation at hand.
I mean, I think, okay, I'll give you a takeaway, right? Severe mental illness is one of the saddest things I've ever seen in my life. You know what I mean? And who it affects and how it affects them. And our lack of ability to treat, manage, deal with that is also one of the saddest things I've ever seen in my entire life. And so maybe that's the best thing I can say about any of that, but it definitely, I can say that nobody has that experience. Like I am better because of it. But it was a hard job. It was a hard facility. I mean, it was, I don't think any of them listened to this, so I'll just be a little bit real, but like, it was managed so poorly, and the people that worked there were not taken care of. You know, I mean, it's not an easy population to work with. The injuries, the psychological injuries from that population and how things were handled, you know, it did teach me a lot, more than any textbook ever could, probably, I would say.
There's not a lot of successes, right? And like what society looks at as a successful completion of treatment, or, you know, it's a lot of, whether it's long-term care or, you know, other terrible things.
It's right. Just lock these people up because, you know, they hurt people and you're never going to fix them. So they don't deserve, you know, it's sad. It is really, really sad.
Sure. Well, tell us a little bit about your practice and your passion. What is it that you do now on a daily basis serving this population?
Yeah. So I've kind of explored in a lot of different areas, mostly because this population isn't like knocking down my door for help, right? Like I'm the last guy most of these people want to see. And I respect that, you know. But trying to reach a very underserved population, I've had to kind of put myself out there, which I'm not super comfortable with when, you know, I'm in the business of misery, right? I used to work with people and they'd say, well, just advertise, get out there. And I'm like, that's hard to do, you know? And in this population, it's word of mouth, honestly. Like, it doesn't matter what I put out there. It doesn't matter how I try. What matters is this guy's like, hey, I saw this lady. She's not crazy. She's, you know, probably kind of a, you know what, but she helped. She helped me, you know, and I got really lucky because some of my first responders were amazing and they were respected in their professions and in their community. So like it meant something that those were the people saying, hey, you should go see this lady. And so that word of mouth is really how I get most of my people to come through my door. And secondly, honestly, I know the chief of police that I've worked with, and he came to me about retention and hiring and lack of candidates. And honestly, he came to me and he said, I need to replace the psych testing for hiring because it's expensive and I'm not getting anywhere. And I need something different. Can you produce something different for me? And so I did a whole bunch of research and a lot of, which let's be real, there is no research in a lot of these areas. All I can mostly find it comes out of California, which is, you know, all I need to say about that. And, but at least it gave me some groundwork of this is what we're doing. This is why. And I live in a small community. So what's required in my community, you know what I mean? I understand that that's different with bigger departments and et cetera. But so we looked at like core competencies and we integrated that into their hiring processes. We did scenario based interviews and it was interesting because it was very much so let's screen people in instead of screen them out, because let's face it, like there is not a lot of people sitting in the hire me pool when it comes to like law enforcement right now. because of what's going on, right? We know that. And so we looked at that and we rolled that into retention. He let me really dabble in his department. I did some surveys to try to figure out where they were happy, where they weren't happy. And then I started doing assessments when they pre-hire. And so they come in, and rather than do a psych test that says, you know, you're rigid in your thinking, you're black and white, et cetera, because most law enforcement is that way. We looked at what makes them vulnerable. So they got an ACE. They got a lot of this was, again, there's no research, and I'm very scientifically based. So it's like, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to create research that's applicable to small rural communities, right? And so for the sake of needing some assessments, we looked at the PTSD, you know, assessments that were used in the VA, because I didn't have a lot of choices, right? So the PCL5 and the LEC5 with the criteria A, because I get guys that have been in the military and want to go into law enforcement, or I get, you know, somebody who's been in another department. And so just knowing what they've experienced, how they've coped with it, if they've sought help about it, led us into, okay, so what can you expect? Full transparency. And I was like, this is going to go to the chief and he's going to be able to look at this. And this is like, so when there's a critical incident, he can say, okay, nobody says they need a debriefing. Nobody says they struggle with this. Nobody has any issues. We're good, which is classic. That's classic with law enforcement right now. Nobody wants any help. Everybody's fine with this. Nobody is fine. I guarantee you nobody is fine, right? And so now he can be more personable and he can say, hey, I know this person's gone through this. Maybe this is their first, this is their worst, this is their, you know what I mean? And they have this history. Okay, I'm going to double check in with this guy. I go meet with him and he's like, yeah, I guess I am struggling, because one-on-one, that's a lot safer to say, I'm not okay with this, versus a whole room of people. If you're the new cop or you're the new deputy or you're the new, and everybody's like, nah, don't worry about it, man. You've seen one, you've seen them all, right? They're not going to be like, I can't think about this. I can't, you know, that's scary. And people are going to make fun of you. We know that, right? We know that about that culture. You guys eat your young. So we made a system that hopefully gave them the ability to be like, I know who to check in on and when to check in on them best that we can, because I'm sure it's not perfect. I can't predict the future. Secondly, I gave them the tools. This might be where you struggle. Your first, this might be difficult. And I do that because I focus a lot on neural pathways and experiences. Obviously, you know, I do EMDR. I suggest sometimes, I don't care if you see me, I want you to see somebody, because those pathways are going to give you trouble down the line. You know what I mean? And then full transparency that goes. And they've met me then. They know if I get to be their first contact as a therapist, like, I'm like, thank God, right? Because Susie down the road might treat them differently, you know?
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah, it really does. That, so back to your research, when you were looking for research, and I'm making an assumption here, you're talking law enforcement specific research. Why do you think there's not, and I share that because I've done some real looking in specific areas for some law enforcement based research. I have my kind of ideas as to why that's not out there, but why do you think that there's not the research out there on this population?
I think they're underserved, right? For a lot of reasons. So it's not there. And I'm gonna be real, but like, people don't like cops,
right?
They don't focus on them. They got to enforce the law and they got to help you through the misery that you're living in, right? I mean, it's not like, let me save your kitten and put out your fire. We know that some first responders look nicer or are nicer because they don't have to do this second piece, right? I don't have to give you a ticket and call you with some terrible news. I just have to call you with some terrible news and console you and be nice to you and et cetera. I just saved your life, right? So and I think there's just, they have to do tough stuff. And so people, the money, Brad, it's the money too. Like, right. Never mind.
Well, part of that, I hear what you're saying, and I agree with you on several levels. And Austin, maybe I jumped in because you have your hand on your mic. Did you have something you want to add to that?
No, keep going. I'll go when you finish.
Well, so underserved, I agree on all those. One is in my mind, I've thought about this quite a bit. One is the money. There's not a, it's government service and law enforcement's underfunded. And now it's underfunded, purposely, intentionally underfunded.
Defunded,
right? That's the proper, appropriate word. And two, you're talking about a population that disseminates consequences, and we live in a society that is, now thinks they should be free of consequences, and we're the executioner mm-hmm. of those consequences of a traffic ticket or going to jail or taking your freedom, as it were, away of walking around in public and put you in jail. That's what this population's been called to do as a result of something that you mm-hmm. did in intentional or unintentional, which is for a court to decide. And then that court system is a whole another broken system. But two, mm-hmm. I think, to grab some onus on our end, I think we're such a guarded population. I think we're such a guarded, group, a community, that when somebody like Brooke says, "Hey, I want to actually do a research paper on this," it is F you as the answer to all questions, mm-hmm. And which I don't want to tell you anything. I've been a part of some of those research pieces, and every answer that I gave, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, I should not be doing this, or I don't want to do this, or this is going to make me or our population look bad. And the transparency becomes very skewed in that as well, to own that on our community, on our end a little bit. Is that fair?
100%.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
They don't trust. And I'm, I said, I want it to be optional. Like, they don't have to, like, their information can be left out of this, And even the chief was like, "No, it should be in there." And I was like, "Stop it. No, it doesn't need to be." Like, if they don't want to give it, they don't want to give it,
right.
And the more we force them, the more I'm out. So don't do that. Don't wreck it for me because you think it should be that easy, And he respected that, but I just don't think he thinks that way.
Well, and Sherry Martin's latest research, I think, was very well responded to, because she put out a national research study, and the responses back were pretty high, which is pretty abnormal in this community. I'll have to go back and look. I don't want to do it from memory, but it was a pretty high percentage of responses back from her, and it was great findings. Very interesting findings.
Well, that's relative. That's relative, right?
Sure.
Like, yeah, that's compared. I think she even talked about this when Ben and I sat in her class. There's still something around, what, 350,000 members of the FOP, something like that. And I think that this survey that was talking about work conditions and burnout and all of these things, I think it had 5,000 responses. So that's a major victory. 5,000 responses out of 350,000. That's in the medical community, that's a pretty abysmal, ratio there. But in here, it's great. And that's jumping on that too. Like, I remember talking to somebody from Johns Hopkins who they were trying to put together. It's basically like a Whoop, like, those little bracelets that measure blood pressure and all that stuff. They're trying to build those, but specifically for law enforcement to measure when somebody is, basically escalated to the point that they need to go off duty or in whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But when I was talking to one of the researchers there, they just said that the fact of the matter is that there's just so much underreporting that to try and make it a survey, like you use ACEs, for example, 10 questionnaire built in the 80s. Yeah, they had hundreds of thousands of people take that survey and then study for 20 years before it really was accepted. in the medical community. We don't have hundreds of thousands of cops that are willing to tell the truth for 20 years in order to gather information.
And that's another statement that requires defining with a multitude of reasons behind why they don't tell the truth, which is, you know, their own shame, their own trauma, protection, locking down. You know, it's a pretty hard population to serve, Brooke. And I just want to say I appreciate you doing it. I appreciate you what you do. And I think to go back up
Austin, can you send that to me in a video of what he'd, so I have something good too, like him talking nice about me. Can you send me an email of him? I need my, you know.
Yeah. I'm worried about your ego too, though. So maybe not.
For sure. Well, and to back up a little bit, when you first started, you were talking about trust and credibility, but right before you went into this piece of research, you were talking about the trust and credibility of kind of how you built your business and word of mouth. And you know, that is one of the, key pieces for law enforcement is if my partner Austin says that's a good thing, then it must be a good thing. But getting in that first level of somewhere is the hardest piece. But it is until we know you're a trusted member of this community, you really struggle working in it.
100%. I mean, and it's still, I don't know. I mean, I guess kind of going back on that is like, I get it. Like, I don't blame them, especially today. Like, if it's not, you know, you can't trust somebody for help. I mean, the policies, the procedures that are in place alone, you know what I mean? Like, that instills such a level of mistrust. I hate saying trauma, but you know what I mean? Like that's, I'm up against that almost on a regular basis, Brad, with whether it's driven from leadership or, and just because of like, let's say officer involved shooting or even equipment, like the refusal to provide the right equipment or equipment that is suitable for one that, you know, needs to continue in this position. Or, I mean, it's just, there's a reason that mistrust is there. And I don't think that should be overlooked either, because it's appropriate. It's 100% appropriate for the things that we look back on and we follow this history. Like it makes sense and it's fair.
Well, let's talk about, you know, one of the things that I think you're really passionate about is this, kind of this brain science piece. And how do you implement that mode of thinking within your practice when you have, talk to us a little bit about your passion in that area of how you interact with clients when they come in and you start educating them or even introducing this, or maybe you don't, maybe it's just in the back of your brain. You're already thinking along those lines while, you know, leading this first responder down this road of therapeutic services. Mm-hmm. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah. No, I'm 100% transparent. I 100%, because I think that lets them know, like, I mean, when you talk about mistrust and trust, right? I don't hide anything. I don't cut corners. I'm straightforward. I'm like, this is what you're looking at. This is why, this is what we can do about it. You can choose to go this way or this way. You know, it's just real. I'm just straightforward. I don't do wait lists. I don't do long. I mean, I don't have time for that. And so when a first responder walks in my door, the work begins immediately. And because if they've walked in my door, this didn't just start yesterday. This has been going on for a long time and it's taken them to get here. So like, I don't wait, if that makes sense. I don't wait to get them in. I don't wait to start treatment. That's the whole point of starting before they even get into this position, right? Is like, let's clear these pathways so that my hope is we can do maintenance EMDR every time there's a critical incident. So for example, right, the one individual that we know and happen to both love, right? Like she's got it figured out. She did the work. introduced to the work, right? Had her first round of EMDR after she had struggled and was going to leave the profession and was engaging in self-destructive ways that, like, she was miserable, 100% miserable, and still on the street, which to me is like, what are we doing? Because, well, another side note, right? When you start to look at wellness, and wellness isn't guaranteed. We know that, right? And so when your wellness decreases, your likelihood of misconduct or ethical behaviors also goes down. And nobody wants to talk about that. Nobody wants to openly talk about police misconduct, ethical behaviors, moral dilemmas, moral conflict, moral stress, right? Because that's all like, oh, you know, we'll just watch that on the news play out and watch another person's life be destroyed, you know, where I'm like, this makes you susceptible for mistakes. Very clear about that, because it's important that they understand that, you know? And so the brain science of the piece is, like you talked about the ACEs, right? There's just not a lot of good tools to use quickly that are usable across a lot of different avenues. And so I am immediately looking at their history before they come in. They get an ACE, they get those assessments, so I know what I'm dealing with, because that is important to me when it comes to, you know, neural pathways and, you know, past trauma, childhood, because we are what we experience, right? That impacts our lens 100%. Not everybody thinks that way. I respect that. That's just how in my practice I often see things. And so I'm immediately looking at negative cognitions to tackle with EMDR, because it's fast. They can see results, and that's important. If they can see results, they're likely to come back. If they have to come here and talk about miserable things, they're less likely to come back because they don't feel any better, you know? Am I even still answering the question?
No, you are.
You lost me. Squirrel.
No, what I like is, I think an important part that I'm hearing from you is that you're just average talk therapy before you get to the core of an issue is actually 9 months. It's just average, yeah. Right? And this isn't a first responder number, because they don't have that number. But nope. Like, that just takes too long. And mm-hmm. This population is not going to go to you once a week for 9 months to nope. Finally talk about, you know, a critical incident or, you know, something in their childhood. And mm-hmm. that's been the issue of bypassing. I mean, we're still kind of back to depending on history, though, right? Which is depending on their reporting of what's happened. In being in partnership with the department, though, I'm guessing you can at least know a little bit more about maybe something that they'd seen on the job or something like that to kind of bypass that 9 months.
Oh yeah, I mean, and you'd be surprised how quickly they'll just dump it for you. Like if they walk in and they can relate, it's like, well, this is what's going on. And they even know that I know their leadership and I'm transparent. And I'm like, well, that is terrible. Why might that have been that way, or what happened, or how come? I no longer do. I never actually have ever done any kind of, you know, assessments for like work. Are they, what do they call them? Sorry. I'm going to sound like an idiot. I just lost my mind. Yeah. We don't do those.
You developed a bunch of trust right there. Cause that's the same. We don't do them either. Cause it's bullshit.
It's bullshit. 100%. All that says is way to keep your people unwell. Nice work, you know?
Yep.
And we operate, they all operate that way. So it's just absolute bullshit. And so creating that, I think, is where we're going. And then the idea of like, if you have had a critical incident, I joined Brad made fun of me for this, because he's like, oh good, add more terrible things into your life. But like, I joined the critical incident stress team here in town, because like, I just wanted to know when they were happening, you know. I was like, can I just get a police scanner? Can one of you just put a radio in my office, so like, I know, I'll just call them and be like, are you okay? Because it would just be easier, you know. But for the most part, the ones that have done it and have stayed with it and know me and done the processing. So like our friend, if she doesn't sleep, she gets one sleep and she's like, nope. And she'll call me and be like, I need to come in. And then she's done. It's one, because we've cleared those pathways. She processes that incident and she doesn't have to suffer. And I'd love to be corrected, because I'm sure there's things that I say that are not in agreement with other people, but like, if I'm wrong, I'd like to know. I mean, I know that we used to say we wait with EMDR, you have to ensure that they, but these guys, like, if I said to them, okay, where's, now I'm probably gonna get in trouble in the EMDR world, but like, where's your container and let's secure our space and let's be like, they'd be like, what in the fuck are you talking about? I'm not doing that. You know what I mean? So that's why the science is so important, because they can identify with that. It feels real. It's not fluffy. It's just like, this is what your brain is doing. Do you want to keep doing that? If not, okay, let's do this. You know, it works for me. I don't know if it would work for everybody, but.
Well, here's the argument with that EMDR safe space conversation, which I've talked to our EMDR specialist quite a bit about. This is like, the people that she believes that the people that created that rule in the EMDR world aren't dealing with somebody that, if you actually look on from the outside looking in, they seem stable. Mm-hmm. Like they are more of a stable pop. They are going to work. They are paying their bills. They are due now. There's tons of terrible stuff happen, mostly relationships, a lot of debt, you know, sleep, diet, you know, nicotine personal intake, alcohol intake, all
personal degradation.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot more of that in this population, but like from a grand scheme, they're stable in the eyes of the community.
Apparently.
Trying to, yeah, yeah,
right.
Outside appearance. So they don't need, they're resilient, generally speaking.
100%.
And so being so much more resilient allows you to go to that space quicker than the average person.
Mm-hmm.
However, they're hurting very significantly. They're not, and not all, yes. But as
yeah.
The people that we're referring to in this population, it is a large number. They're hurting, and they're looking for help, and they're looking mm-hmm. for answers. They just don't know where to go.
Yeah, and I think what I'm learning so much more is like most of these first responders, it isn't even the incidents. You know what I mean? Like. They've like you said, they're resilient, they've seen it, they've done it, they've been through it. It's not that, it's so much of what happens after, how have they been taken care of, what is their social capital, what are they doing after these things happen, and how are they being treated, you know, if that makes sense. Like when I got to go up against that, and that after is negative, if I can't get to that quickly, that is a lot of work to undo that psychological, what should we call that? I don't know, to put it nicely. I mean, it's betrayal. We know that, but like it matters. And that's my other component of what I'm doing is wellness is 100%. I believe, I know I'm just one person, is 100% top down. And if your leadership does not get it, and it's not just like, oh, we have a wellness program we offer, you know, then nobody is doing wellness in an agency. Nobody, I would say.
Well, I certainly think,
fight me on it, because I would love to hear.
You certainly don't have to apologize to about the words administrative betrayal or anything in connection with that, because that's a real thing, and we need to talk about it. These conversations need to take place, because this happens. You know, I've experienced it from people that I trusted and were people that I thought actually had my back. And the impact that had on me was devastating. And that was
100%.
I can't even begin to describe how devastating that actually was. It took a long time to, and still to this day, overcoming that. So I feel for these men and women out here who have experienced something similar, which, you know, the where you run that out, if you run that all the way out, these are the people that ultimately, you know, have a gun in their hand and saying, this is not worth this anymore. I don't have any other options. I mean, that's mm-hmm. and this is being September month. I don't want us to leave this conversation without addressing, you know, kind of some of that suicide piece, but ultimately this betrayal wounds so deeply, and it's so, there's just so many ways to overcome that and prevent it from happening, you know, just being conscious mm-hmm. of your communication, being conscious of, of all the players. And ultimately, I believe it comes down to, appearances of a chief or an administrator saying, this is going to make us look bad, so we need to shore this up. And if that means, we Austin has to take the fall for this, then so be it. And this happens all the time.
It's incredibly defeating for me, who's not even in it, right? But, usually when my bucket is full, right, and I've called there and I've been like, I can't do this. Like, I'm tapped. Like, this, I get so angry. I get so angry because, yeah, let's talk about suicide prevention, right? I mean, do they understand? Nobody wants to put this shit out there and be real, No, the numbers are even skewed when we look at line of duty deaths versus why, right? The suicide numbers of law enforcement and first responders are incredibly high. And it's like the top says, someone's going to fall. I don't care who, someone's going to fall. And then there's no accountability. There's no, because we had to look a certain way or do a certain thing, and it's like, the problem, and I don't know how much of this you even want me to say, but like the problem is, the guys on the streets are busting their asses to do so many things. And then, even they're the ones that look like they're the problem. But the reality is like the problem is at the top. The problem is 100% at the top. I will say that. And you can take that out of this if you want to. But like, not a lot of guys will come to me and say, help me be a better leader. Help me do this job better. Because, well, a few things, right? I think maybe Brad, this came from you at one point, but like those that get promoted, those that get put into those positions aren't necessarily the right people. We know that. It's typically your yes men, right? The guys that are going to make the departments look good, the guys that are going to, most everybody else is still doing the job that, deserves to be at the top because either they've ruffled too many feathers or they're too loyal or they're too, whatnot. So I don't get a lot of leaders coming in here and being like, hey, how do I be better? How do I treat my people better? And then even higher political, somebody is going to roll for that. And that makes me so angry.
Arguably some of the people that we're talking about are the leaders that you want in those institutions, our mutual friend there, she would make an amazing leader just because she, when you get to that point of where she's at, you have so much empathy for others around you and you have such a broad perspective of the, you see the big picture, you see the totality of what's happening. And consequently you adjust your life, your execution of your leadership, your communication, all of it's different with regard to all these people who are doing a hard job. It's incredibly difficult job. Hats off to all those cops and firefighters and veterans out there doing this incredible job. I love that we still have those people out there signing up for this occupation.
Yeah. 100%.
So I'm going to throw a little bit of a wrench into what you were just talking about, just because.
Perfect.
Nationally, I've seen this part as well, where you're talking about the issue with the leadership at the top, where they're maybe not promoting wellness or not promoting healing, whatever it may be. Then on the flip side of that, which there is not really a middle ground at the moment, on the flip side of that, there are leaders that are making promises to help people that they cannot fulfill. So, let's say there's a department that we know of that has basically guaranteed if you go to treatment, you self-report, you will walk back into your position the next day. That's a promise that they can't fulfill. Because if there is, maybe that person needs to medically retire. Maybe that person, has gotten themselves into such a bad issue at work or at home or whatever it may be that they can no longer be employed there. And they self-reported. So they think, oh, I self-reported. And even though there's all these issues going on in the background, I will have my job no matter what. Well, the city manager or those other people come in and say, this isn't good. Immediately when that happens, the first time that promise isn't fulfilled, it actually has the same effect as not promoting wellness. It is, they're liars. Yeah. they're not. And so there's not a middle ground really right now. I think there's the piece that you talked about, and then there's the flip side of let's try and promote it so heavily. Oh.
Wow.
That looks good.
What just happened there?
That was awesome.
Okay. Yeah. I guess I just had a really good idea.
That was an enlightened moment.
Yeah.
Now I'm worried about your ego. Yeah.
It should be. I kind of lost my train of thought there because of that weird fireworks show, but I'll pick that up.
What I'm saying? Because I agree with you. I think there's mm-hmm. And I talk all the time about this pendulum swing. This seems like we can't ever really find this middle ground that's healthy, but we're either all the way over here or we're all the way over here, to where, I agree 100% with you, Austin. You're making these bold claims. We being administrators saying we're going to do this no matter what, and the end result is, wow, that didn't turn out the way I had thought it would. Now I'm committed to something that I can't fulfill, which is giving them their spot back or their job back or their whatever through. And let's face it, if we're talking about cops and all of them, firefighters, veterans, I mean, we do some pretty stupid things. So we get ourselves in a bind. You know, we can talk about all the reasons why, you know, trauma and mental health and all those, but we get ourselves in a bind. We put ourselves in a corner to where the decision now becomes out of our hands as to whether we can or can't come back to where we wanted to be. Is that what you were getting at?
Yeah. But then when that claim has been made and it doesn't follow through, you've made everyone say, told you so. I knew that that was going to happen.
Yeah.
So then you take 5 years back, 5 years step back, and now nobody's reaching out.
Right.
So it's just, it's tough middle ground. And I don't know if we have it right yet.
I would say, and just correct me, I mean, I love to debate, but the reality is like the only antidote for that is transparency. And so if you make those claims and that happens, then you have accountability in that, right? It's just like my guys that run the interstates or run the, you know, and they work so hard for these arrests, right? Or even local, right? And then all of a sudden, like Brad, you touched briefly on the judicial system, right? Which is a whole nother mess. But like when those things get dismissed, so what that means to them, right, is like, this guy doesn't care about the things I've done here. They don't care about my life because I put that at risk to make sure that this guy gets put away. And then this attorney, this whatever has started on that. So the idea is like, and this is going to go in my training in November. And because leadership will always be at fault. They will always be at fault to the guys on the streets. And I say that knowing I've never been a cop. Okay. Like full transparency there. And because they need somebody to take the fall, they need somebody to blame for the fact that like their hard work went unnoticed or dismissed. But the reality is that leadership needs to come back and be transparent with their people. Like, hey, you did good work. Unfortunately, this is the roadblock we've hit. This is why. And you hold the people accountable that are accountable. And a good leader would say, I'm going to go get that state's attorney. I'm going to go get that county attorney and let him come in here and tell my guys that. Because to be a leader, it takes more than saying yes. It means you got to look at that attorney and say, fine, you want to dismiss those charges, you go right ahead. But you're going to tell my deputy that. You're going to tell my guy that because I'm not carrying that for you. That's just accountability, I think. And I think that like, well, society, we struggle with that, right? But the same goes for the hierarchy. Like, be accountable. And if it means that you would know to never make that claim anyhow, right, Austin? It means that like someone in that position, if they're focused or not focused on wellness, you need to know you don't make those claims. Most cops get it. And I say cops because I mean first responders all, but like I've just been doing a lot of work with that group of individuals, but like they know right and wrong. They don't have a problem being held accountable. They just want to know the truth. They do not like being lied to. We know that, but I don't know. I mean, to me, It's an easy fix. And that's the leadership that I work with here. That's what we talk about. What'd you tell them? What'd you say? Well, I don't know. I told them what was happening. That's it. Well, they hate you now. Good luck. Like, why weren't you transparent with where the problem is? If you don't tell them that, it will always be your fault. And I like the guy at the top here. Honestly, he's a good guy. He's a really good guy, but he makes mistakes just like everybody does. But he's not scared to come in and be like, where did I fuck up? Why am I in this situation? I don't know a lot of leaders that would let me survey their people and be like, what do you hate about it? What do you want to change? You know? And that's what we need, that transparency.
Well, I think if we...
Because it's not their fault at the top all the time, all the time.
If we run this out a little bit deeper, which I love this conversation, and I hate to chase a rabbit too deeply on this because we're headed towards the end of our conversation. But this first responder piece, and specifically cops, they live in two worlds, if not more so, more than that. But the what happens on the street, which is this truth. Truth is real on the street. I mean, it is what it is on the street. And then when you go back to the office, truth becomes very skewed. It becomes more a matter of perspective and oftentimes adjusted accordingly based upon whose viewpoint it is. On the street, there's just one viewpoint. It is good and bad. It is life or death. So they live in this, and there's more to that. We can run that out, but it runs deeper than that. But there's a code of working on the street. And then when you go back to the station, that code doesn't apply anymore. Sometimes, not all, but sometimes. And that's where that betrayal starts to plant seeds of sorts of, and that could be for a variety of reasons. I feel like it could be the one that irritates me the most is this liability issue. I can't tell Austin something because if I say that, then it may come back and bite me in some type of litigation later. So HR has told me that I can't say this or I can't have an honest conversation with Austin about where he's at or what's happening. You know, if he's got himself into trouble, then I need to sit Austin down and have a really transparent conversation with him. But the lawyers say that I cannot have that, which runs counter to your point, Brooke. Can we not have an honest conversation? Well, no. Some people take the viewpoint that no, we cannot have this honest conversation because you may come back and sue me. So now we enter into this whole point of now lawyers have skewed this. And this is just one area of one reason as to why this has become so messy and so difficult for a cop to actually get help. There's just one perspective.
Yep.
Does that make sense? Does that resonate with
you? Yeah.
Yeah.
And we started that a long time ago when we started deciding that, you know, we were going to sue for all things. I mean, you knew that this is the making of years in, you know, well, someone has to pay.
Right.
You know,
right. Well, Brooke, this is if you were actually let's turn and let's kind of start closing this conversation out. If you were actually had a minute to talk to, you know, the first responder veteran population out here, what kind of advice would you give them as to how to stay healthy, how to actually keep themselves healthy? If they weren't healthy, where would you encourage them to go, or what would you encourage them to do? Your little tidbit of wisdom from your chair.
I mean, I think that's different for everybody because what works for some doesn't work for others, right? But I think ultimately the idea of, well, just like me, like if I want to keep doing this, which I do because it's important to me, then I got to take care of me regardless. So, you know, if it's exercise, if it's peer-to-peer support, if it's mental health, if it's whatever, like you're worthy of that. You are 100% worthy of taking care of yourself and being selfish in that. And yes, you can tell me, you know, eat your own words, Brooke, because I know how hard that is. I know how hard that is. But, you know, that are worthy of that, because not everybody, nobody, actually nobody, like, I don't know, like, I might hold the stories, but I wasn't there, right? I didn't see the things. I didn't have to see the things. So I can hear the stories and hold the stories for these people, because I'm honored, 100% honored to be the keeper of some of these stories, regardless of what they are. But like, it takes certain people to be able to do that. And I guess that's like just my blind passion for, please keep doing that, because we can't. There's a lot of people that can't do what they do. And so it's okay when it feels like it's overwhelming and I need something more, you know, or I need this or I need that. Like, not everybody can do what you do. So it's important to take care of yourself, however that might be, you know? And just because one doesn't work, it doesn't mean the next might not. Don't quit all of them just because maybe the first one was not, didn't work, you know?
No, that's great.
Is that what that face of yours says? Because I'm wondering, honestly, I'm just like, God, does this guy like despise everything I've said this far? Or is it just his earache? I don't know what you got going on there.
It's 100% the earache. Like I said, it feels like a screwdriver is stabbing my ear constantly. I had to turn the screen off and blow like my nose and like pop my ear. It was lots of fun today. Yeah.
No, that's actually and pretty perceptive, because he was actually looking like he had some. I can always tell when his mind's racing, his mind's turning, because he really gets this stoic look. And I actually thought the same. I thought you were fixing to say something.
It's called dissociation. Thank you.
Yeah, that or RBF. I'm not sure. I don't know if I'm being judged or what the hell. 100%.
He does have RBF. Well, Brooke, this has been awesome. I love the conversation. This has been a great conversation on our culture. And these conversations need to be had more and more. I love the fact that you've come on. I'm so appreciative of you taking time out of your day to come on and visit with us. Brooke Grinning, thanks for coming on the No One Fights Alone podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Chateau Health and Wellness is a 16-bed treatment facility nestled in the foothills of the Wasatch Mountains in Midway, Utah. Chateau's first responder resiliency program is designed to treat the unique challenges and issues that first responders encounter in the course of their careers. Chateau's comprehensive and highly individualized approach to treatment addresses more than just the presenting issues. It addresses the why. Each of their seasoned, trauma-trained, and culturally competent therapists utilize evidence-based, specialized therapies to treat trauma at its core and enable clients to begin the healing process while developing a resilient and healthy relationship with stress. Chateau Health and Wellness is trusted by departments and agencies from around the country to treat responders and veterans. In fact, it is one of only a handful of facilities nationwide that is vetted and approved to treat members of the Fraternal Order of Police. For more information or to speak to a representative, go to chateaurecovery.com or call 888-507-5031.